Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. The recent availability of the initial results from adjuvant trials evaluating trastuzumab in patients with HER2-positive tumors has not only affected the design of future trials for these patients, but also for women with HER2-negative disease. I met with Dr. Hal Burstein for his thoughts on these and other important issues in breast cancer research. Dr. Burstein began our conversation by commenting on new trends in clinical trial design.
We are really splintering breast cancer into several different diseases. So most of the moving forward clinical trials are focusing on biologically defined subsets of breast cancer. There will be specific studies for hormone receptor positive disease, for HER2 overexpressing disease, and for so-called triple negative or basal-like disease. And I think that's reasonable because the questions that are most of interest are probably different in each of those different patient populations.
There were a number of pieces that you wrote before the adjuvant trastuzumab trials coming out saying, hey, not only are these trials maybe going to be positive, but it's going to affect the HER2-negative patients and the trials they go in maybe even more.
Well, that's right, and I think that's ever more true. You know, the things we thought we knew about treating adjuvant chemotherapy, for instance, were all derived from trials that included patients with all different kinds of breast cancer. And for instance, if you look carefully at the role of anthracyclines, a lot of retrospective data suggests that the majority of the benefit of anthracycline therapy is in HER2 overexpressing breast cancer. Well, once you take those HER2 positive cases out of the general mix, not so clear that anthracyclines are critically important. Similarly, a lot of retrospective work now suggests that, you know, the major tweaks of chemotherapy realize most of their benefit in hormone receptor negative breast cancer. For hormone receptor positive breast cancer, it's not so clear that those are major advances. So I think that the idea of separating these tumors out into these different subsets makes a lot of sense, but there are some important challenges there. The first is that it dilutes the patient population base. So instead of, you know, rapid accrual to studies that have thousands of patients on them, we are looking at more carefully selected patients, and that is going to affect accrual. Secondly, it puts a high priority on the quality of testing for tumors. And this is a growing issue now in the community and in the research community where there really is going to be a focus on how good is the testing to define the various subsets. Obviously, if you're going to make clinical decisions on anything from hormone receptor status to HER2 status to a product like an Oncotype DX genomic assay, you have to know the reproducibility and the quality control that goes into it. And that's going to be a real challenge for community oncologists in many ways. So just to take a small example, there are no fewer than 3 expert panels currently convened to discuss HER2 testing. ASCO, NCCN, and College of American Pathology are all issuing guidelines for HER2 testing. And my understanding, though of course the details may change, but my understanding is that most of them will make the same recommendation, namely that either well-done immunohistochemical testing or well-done FISH testing is acceptable, but the key piece is how good is the actual tester? What's the quality control for the pathologist? And they're going to make pathologists show that they can do high-quality testing, or they're going to ask them to get out of the business of doing HER2 testing. That's
from
a big change.
Regulatory licensing type of thing? Or?
For not so much for regulatory, but just for clinical decision-making. So I think if you're a practicing oncologist and you say, okay, I'm going to treat this patient for HER2 overexpressing disease based on the results of this pathology lab, if you don't know the performance characteristic of that lab, you really can't make a good decision about whether or not HER2 really is overexpressed.
And, you know, there's a lot of concern, obviously, about HER2 because of the excitement about adjuvant trastuzumab, but yet I was just speaking with Soon Paik and, quote, ER testing is in much worse shape than HER2 testing.
I don't know that it's in much worse shape, but it's certainly possible that it's in worse shape because when it was appreciated 5 or 6 years ago that HER2 testing was in many ways mediocre, there were a lot of education campaigns and quality initiatives put forward. And it's been shown that you can train people to do a better job. So that same process hasn't happened in ER testing in decades, and that's a real issue. I don't know if Soon talked about the genomic health and the Oncotype experience, but sure. You know, when they start doing very sensitive quantitative RNA measurements for all sorts of genes, including ER and PR,
right.
You know, my understanding is that in many cases, not a lot, but in a small fraction, probably 5 or 10% of cases, they're thought to be ER positive. They find that they're really ER negative. So here's the real lesson, and it's not unique to breast cancer. As soon as you ask the pathology service to tell you more than is there tumor present, how big is it, and are the nodes involved, you introduce a level of expertise that not every pathology group is going to have. And so, like anything else in medicine, experience matters, high volume matters, and we are going to need high quality, high volume pathology testing for all of these new molecular markers that are coming along in all different tumor types. And that's going to be a challenge for the pathologists. The good ones will rise to that challenge by instituting appropriate quality assurance plans, developing specialty and doing certain kinds of testing, and at the same time realizing that they can't do every test well and will send out to or collaborate with people who will do those tests better.
Or there'll be maybe a genomic health answer, which is going to be one place that's going to do a test extremely well.
Well, and the advantage of that is obviously superb quality control and the kind of rigorous documentation that a commercialization of a test will have. Whether that's necessary for every tumor or every setting remains to be seen, but there certainly are advantages to that, and in principle there should be cost savings to having that kind of work done as well.
So given that we are going to have to get this right and that will be critical to the next generation of trials, what do you see as the key questions in the various subsets?
Well, you can imagine a lot of different questions. For the ER overexpressing subsets, obviously we want to optimize endocrine therapy. For the postmenopausal women, there's still sorting out to be done of how best to use AIs, whether there's any role still for tamoxifen, are AIs all the same, what duration of treatment should we be using for either tamoxifen or an AI, those kinds of questions. And then the very big, big question, does chemotherapy really benefit patients that are ER positive? And if so, who are those patients and how do we go about testing them?
You know, in the past, this question was approached about tamoxifen. It's still being addressed. But today, it seems like there's much more sensitivity to the issue of delayed relapse in ER-positive patients. And it seems like that's affected how people think strategically, at least compared to, say, 10 years ago. Is that your take?
I think that's right. I think one of the real lessons of the MA17 trial, which was the trial of extended adjuvant endocrine therapy for women who had finished 5 years of tamoxifen and who then went on to either a placebo or to an AI, what they showed was that an AI in that setting obviously lowered the forward-moving risk of recurrence. And it really reminded people that this is a disease where there are recurrences in years 5 through 10 and even years 10 through 15. Now, it must be said that the risk decreases as time goes by. And for women who have made it out 5, 6, 7, 8 years, they do have a lower and lower chance of recurrence as time goes by. But it's a disease with a very long natural history. So there are opportunities to intervene down the road, and that's particularly true in the ER-positive group. You know, for the ER-negative group, the recurrences are much more typically in years 2, 3, 4, 5, and if you make it to year 5, the risk doesn't go to zero, but it certainly levels out and becomes substantially less. So one of the big differences in those subsets.
Where are you right now in your own non-protocol practice of, you know, 100 postmenopausal women who come to see you to be considered for adjuvant hormonal therapy? How is it playing out? Are you starting many people initially on tamoxifen or any?
You know, I think we've learned a lot about these drugs, and the first discussion I have with patients is that they need anti-estrogen therapy. And the second is to discuss the side effect profiles of the different products. Both can cause hot flashes and night sweats and genital urinary symptoms. Tamoxifen has that slight risk of uterine cancer or thromboembolism. The aromatase inhibitors share a risk of accelerated osteoporosis and an arthralgia syndrome that we are increasingly hearing complaints about from patients, the stiffness in the hands and the joints, and also more sexual dysfunction and atrophic vaginitis. So if patients have a clear reason based on side effect profile to choose one product or another, that obviously is the place where we begin the discussion. Some patients have had tamoxifen or raloxifen in the prevention setting, so that influences my choice. Most patients have no strong reason to pick one or the other up front. And so then I discuss the options of using an AI up front or beginning with tamoxifen for a couple of years and then switching to an AI. I continue to believe that those are both very reasonable options. The differences in the risk of recurrence for the first couple of years between tamoxifen and an AI are vanishingly small. Oftentimes, patients will have preferences. They'll know someone who was on one product or another, or they've read something, and I think those are very reasonable ways to make a choice. Right now, I would guess I'm probably around 50-50, with 50% starting an AI up front and 50% starting tamoxifen for a planned couple of years and then transitioning to an aromatase inhibitor.
And I guess it's interesting because now in the last couple of years, as you know, because I believe you participated in this, we've been doing not only patterns of care studies of oncologists, but also patterns of care studies of clinical researchers who specialize in breast cancer. I think it should be said that looking at those data, those numbers and your approach, I would say is somewhat in the minority in terms of clinical researchers. There are a bunch of people who do that, but there are a lot more researchers who would go probably 75-80% AIs up front. And I know you're often involved in these sort of controversies and, meetings where it's, pro and con and stuff like that. What is the kind of patient who you're starting on tamoxifen, or you just present it to everybody and sort of let them decide?
Well, I have a pretty similar discussion with most patients. Look, the differences between upfront use of tamoxifen and an AI are really small. There's no survival difference. The differences in risk of recurrence over 5 years approaches 2% in the major trials. And so I think that a lot of the push for AI therapy has been a pharmaceutical-driven, advertising-driven, and data-driven process. But in terms of absolute benefit, the differences are vanishingly small. So across the board, when you look at the different settings for using an AI, upfront, after a couple of years of tamoxifen, or after 5 years of tamoxifen, which the major studies have focused on, in each setting, incorporated in AI does better than 5 years of tamoxifen alone. So from the get-go, I speak with patients and I say the question is not to get an AI. The question is, when should you optimally start an AI, and is there still a role for tamoxifen? I don't think it's wrong to put everybody on an AI, and if doctors want to take that approach, I think that's very reasonable. There will be data coming forward before too long comparing one AI product to another, so there will be more information to guide their choices there. But I still wonder whether a planned sequential strategy might be better. There are models that have suggested it might be valuable. We are all eager to see the data from the big 198 trial that will have a planned crossover. But here's the other point, is that, as we said a few moments ago, breast cancer is a disease which has a latency of 10 to 15 years. And we all want to do the right thing for our patients. But as soon as you say that, you realize that the things you do in the first 12 months, 24 months, probably don't matter nearly as much as some of the issues that you're wrestling with for questions like duration of therapy and patient selection based on biology, because those are the things that are going to be affecting the risk of recurrence over the next 15 or 20 years, which is the life course of this disease. So I think you have to put some context around that.
Yeah, it's very hard to think of anything in breast cancer where everybody agrees at this
point. What fun would that be? You wouldn't need these audio tapes. If everybody agreed, we wouldn't need the program.
Okay, so where are we heading in endocrine therapy? What are some of the strategies that you think specifically focusing on the ER-positive patient that might reduce recurrence rates and mortality in the future?
There are three big areas of work, I would say. One is this question we've just been alluding to of, in the early stage setting, AIs, which one, when, for how long, and there are very well-orchestrated trials to tackle those questions, and, there'll be chances to update those experiences annually for the next many years, so there'll be more said about that. The second big one is to really figure out within the group of ER-positive early-stage breast cancer cases, which women need chemotherapy. And obviously, you've had Soon Paik in to discuss the Oncotype DX experience. I like that general approach, and I like that product very much. I think it exemplifies a lot of where most of us think the field should be going.
You're using it in your practice?
And I do use it in my practice, and I find it's very helpful. Patients understand it. It resonates with other things we measure in breast cancer pathology. It gives you a quantitative readout that feels like science, and patients readily understand that, this is an extra piece of information that can help better risk stratify them and therefore allow them to make a better informed choice about chemotherapy. So I think that's going to remarkably change the playing field for ER-positive breast cancer because many of these women will no longer be getting chemotherapy. They simply won't need it based on the prognosis or the natural history of their prognosis. So you need to refine that. That test was developed with tamoxifen-treated patients who received what many would consider old-fashioned chemotherapy. chemotherapy. I actually think the principles are going to be the same, but you would want to look at studies in the adjuvant setting using AIs. You would want to look at studies that use different chemotherapy programs and so on and so forth.
Node-positive patients.
And you'll extend that to node-positive patients, and they're working on all these things. So again, the general principle is how can we use genomic type information, the analysis of multiple gene expression patterns, to refine our prognosis and treatment selection. And that general strategy is happening across cancer medicine, and specifically in breast cancer, this choice of which patients with ER-positive disease need chemotherapy is the place where it's been most readily and successfully exploited so far.
What about new strategies? And I've been kind of curious about the issue of fulvestrant. You know, there have been the issues about the dose, et cetera, but in terms of whether that could add anything, I know there's been discussion, I think, within the intergroup about a delayed fulvestrant trial. I'm curious what's going on with that. And also the issue of combining an AI with fulvestrant, what your thoughts are about that strategy.
Historically, combining multiple endocrine strategies hasn't accomplished that much, with the exception of possibly ovarian suppression and tamoxifen, where there might be an advantage in metastatic disease. Pairing one endocrine therapy with another as opposed to using them sequentially just hasn't accomplished so much. And I guess if you're really looking for examples of that, the ATAC data are the cleanest example, where the combination wasn't better than tamoxifen. So I don't know that combining it's going to be all that valuable. Having said that, there are laboratory models where combining AI treatment with fulvestrant is a highly effective strategy. It's an interesting drug, fulvestrant, the PI for a study that the CLGB has just activated, where patients with hormone receptor positive breast cancer whose tumors have some degree of HER2 overexpression, FISH positive or 1 plus 2 plus or 3 plus by IHC. These patients...
1 plus 2 plus?
1 plus 2 plus or 3 plus.
With FISH negative?
But FISH negative.
Really?
So we're looking for patients where there's some level of HER2 overexpression, will be randomly assigned to fulvestrant alone versus fulvestrant plus the dual kinase inhibitor lapatinib as treatment for metastatic breast cancer. And there, the question we are looking at is whether or not inhibition of EGFR and HER2 can potentiate the effects of an antiestrogen therapy. And as you know, many laboratory models, most notably those of Kent Osborne at Baylor, have suggested that if you interfere with the two pathways at once, that you could make the antiestrogen effect more powerful or potent. So we're going to critically evaluate that in the CALGB, and I'm very pleased to be the PI for that trial. We lowered the bar for HER2 expression compared to just the strongly positives for a couple of reasons. One is that in patients who have aromatase inhibitor resistance, which is what's expected in this trial, there's some suggestion that you might get upregulation of HER2. The other is that the threshold for HER2 expression for a benefit from lapatinib has not yet been established. And the third is that because lapatinib has this EGFR inhibition potential, we wanted to see if some of that might be in play as well. So that study is now being activated around the country, and I hope it will accrue handsomely.
What do we know about the effect of lapatinib in HER2 negative or HER2 a little bit tumors?
There has been relatively little data in use of lapatinib for HER2 normal or HER2 low expressing tumors. In studies of very refractory breast cancer, patients who'd had anthracyclines and taxanes and capecitabine and whose tumors were HER2 negative, there was minimal, essentially zero activity of lapatinib in a open label phase 2 trial. And in their study of inflammatory breast cancer amongst tumors that were HER2 negative but EGFR positive, there was one response amongst 12 such patients with extensive inflammatory breast cancer. So on the one hand, it looks like the majority of the benefit of lapatinib will be realized in patients that are strongly HER2 overexpressing. On the other hand, whether that's something that can be still captured and exploited in the HER2 lower levels of expression, particularly as we're doing this study, is something we want to critically address.
Now, are you going to look at survival, or are you going to get into crossover or anything in this study?
So this study, the primary endpoint is progression-free survival. We obviously will look at overall survival and response rate as well.
But people can cross over after?
The presumption is that people could cross over, and obviously they can receive other anti-HER2 therapy down the road.
I know that the UCLA group, and Dennis Lehman particularly, has been very interested in the idea of fulvestrant and trastuzumab, you know, and to some extent because of what you said, but also they always liked the idea of getting rid of the estrogen receptor as opposed to another, and I guess they had some mechanism, I guess they had some laboratory data to support that. Where are we in clinical trials looking at that combination?
I'm not sure where studies stand with that. Fulvestrant does bind to the estrogen receptor and causes degradation of the receptor, which is, in theory, a potential advantage over selective estrogen receptor modulators like tamoxifen. Whether that is clinically valuable isn't really known. There are expected to be data at San Antonio looking at aromatase inhibitor therapy with or without the addition of trastuzumab.
Right.
And, you know, the guess from the press releases would be that, you know, that has some impact on progression-free survival and may not have any impact on overall survival or long-term outcomes. So I think there's still room to explore whether these combined biological therapies really are going to make a big difference for patients.
What about the issue of delayed fulvestrant a la MA17 and what was done with an aromatase inhibitor? Is that going to move forward?
I know there's been discussion about that. Exactly as you say, the question would be for women who are finishing 5 years or so of an AI, should they then switch to fulvestrant? Should they switch to tamoxifen? Those would be things that are studyable. And I know there has been dialogue along those lines. I do not know the current status of those trials.
You've participated in our Meet the Professors programs where we have docs in practice presenting cases. And somebody always presents a patient who, you know, ER-positive tumor, who relapses, you know, 5, 10, even, you know, 15 years later. Every time I see those cases, I think about what the doc thinks, thinking back a year before, 2 years before, when they saw the patient in follow-up, whether or not maybe they second-guessed themselves, should I have started an AI patient who got tamoxifen 10 years ago, et cetera. How do you approach those patients in your practice right now?
Well, for patients who finished 5 years of tamoxifen and who are now many years out from their treatment, there really are no data that reinitiation of anti-estrogen therapy would be valuable. If you look at the MA17 data, it seems that in the women who got placebo for a couple years and then went on to an AI, you can still sort of lower the risk of recurrence moving forward by reintroducing an AI. That would be in approximately year 7 or 8 of their lifespan of breast cancer. But the benefits in absolute terms are pretty small because the event rate is still pretty small in these women. So I think it's something to discuss for women who finish tamoxifen therapy and are now in the, you know, couple of years after their treatment. But I find a couple of things are worth remembering. The first is that, again, in absolute terms, the benefits of reinitiation of anti-estrogen therapy would be pretty low, especially for patients who had lower risk breast cancers. The second is that, you know, clinicians know their patients, and there are several different kinds of women who are on adjuvant endocrine therapy. There are women who have no side effects whatsoever and are happy to take anti-estrogen therapy for as long as they possibly can, and it doesn't bother them. And then there are women who have a calendar and are counting down the days till they are done with taking their prescriptions because they hate the side effects of estrogen deprivation, or they don't like the idea of taking pills, or they're worried about the side effects that they might develop over time. And so, you know, by knowing the patient, one can help them. The other point is that, you know, none of these trials have follow-up beyond years 8, 9, 10. So, you know, we like to think and we expect that, you know, we will have some impact on risk of recurrence in years 11, 12, 13, and 14. But to date, there are no data besides for use of tamoxifen that that's actually true. And so I don't think either doctors or patients should be beating themselves up too much over those possibilities.
Continuing the theme of current clinical research and your particular interest, let's talk a little bit about the HER2-positive patient. You mentioned one trial. What are some of the other studies that are being considered right now?
So ER-positive breast cancer, we've focused on. The second big group, obviously, is HER2-overexpressing disease. I think that there are several veins of research that are going on there as well. Obviously, now with the tremendous outpouring in 2005 of the major adjuvant trials, there's a lot of retrospective cleanup work. People want to look and see if they can figure out which tumors really benefit from trastuzumab most markedly. Is there some marker, whether it's c-MYC or TOPO2 or what have you, that's going to really pick patients who do or don't need trastuzumab, or if they get trastuzumab, has such a fabulous prognosis that they don't need anything else. In terms of treatment, the next big trials are going to be from the Breast International Group, and that will be a 4-arm randomized trial of trastuzumab. This is for patients who have HER2-positive breast cancer who would have had chemotherapy and who will receive trastuzumab versus lapatinib versus a combination of the two versus a sequential treatment program of, I believe, trastuzumab and then lapatinib.
So everybody will get trastuzumab?
Actually, no. Some patients will get just lapatinib and some patients will get a planned sequence of crossover. So trastuzumab versus lapatinib versus a combination versus a crossover.
I know there's been a lot. I mean, I've been hearing about this for like 2 years, at least even before this all came out. And there's always been this controversy of the lapatinib alone.
I think there are several controversies to this trial. The first is about the name of the trial. They used to call it Aphrodite, but apparently some other clinical research group, like in cardiology or something, had already patented that name, so they need a new name.
Yeah, I've heard it was the trial formerly known as Aphrodite.
The trial formerly known as Aphrodite, that's right. The rock star previously known as Prince. The second controversy is that this study follows the HERA treatment program, where patients would, for the most part, receive chemotherapy first and then receive the biological therapy afterwards, with the option of giving the biological therapy concurrently with taxane therapy. I actually think that's not the best way to give these drugs. I've been impressed that the best results seen with trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting and with trastuzumab and lapatinib in the metastatic setting are when you pair these products with chemotherapy. And I actually think that by not insisting on giving these drugs with chemotherapy, you probably do not optimize the beneficial effects of these drugs. And I think that's actually a fairly substantial critique of the study. The third point is the one you alluded to, which is that, gee, we have an awful lot of good quality data on trastuzumab, and not everybody's going to get that. And I think that that will affect accrual in some quarters. Obviously, there's been a lot of excitement about lapatinib, but I think that that is a potential weakness of the study design. On the other hand, you know, you have to bring new things forward and you need corporate sponsorship for trials, and so hard choices have to be made. But I think that that will affect some patients and doctors' willingness to contribute to that study.
How would you feel about participating in that study?
I think for many patients it's a very reasonable study. On the other hand, if you had a 28-year-old woman with 14 children or, you know, some tremendously compelling story and a very high-risk HER2-positive breast cancer, would you really feel comfortable not randomizing her to trastuzumab treatment at this time? And I'm not sure one would necessarily.
That's interesting. So you, in a way, you're suggesting maybe you or somebody who thinks the way you do might specifically pick out borderline patients where maybe they're not even sold the trastuzumab because they're node negative, 1.2 centimeters,
etc. It'll be interesting to see how accrual goes. And again, there will be, over the next few months, more data, I'm sure, coming along about lapatinib that will hopefully reinforce the data we've seen for that drug. Clearly, there is the recognition that trastuzumab isn't a perfect drug, so there are opportunities to do things. But, you know, there's awfully good data in support of trastuzumab right now, and I think that may, especially in the U.S., affect patient selection for the trial. The other direction that's being taken here is the NSABP,
right,
and they are going to pair bevacizumab with trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting, assuming that that is a safe and feasible combination. So that'll be an interesting set of trials as well. So there's obviously a lot of work being done in the HER2 overexpressing realm.
3 years from now, am I going to be talking to you about triple biologic therapy? It seems like we're seeing more combinations of biologics.
Yeah, we are.
On
the one hand, you have to think that's a good thing. Polychemotherapy doesn't have that much to recommend it, and polybiological therapy hopefully will be clinically valuable. The hard thing is going to be, first of all, running those studies and actually accumulating the data. And then from a societal point of view, the hard thing is going to be figuring out how to pay for all this, because those will be unbelievably expensive adjuvant treatment programs.
Are most of the new adjuvant studies, for example, this so-called or formerly known Aphrodite trial, going to put a lot of energy into acquiring tissue? And I mean, the whole issue you mentioned, c-MYC, topo-2, all these markers that are coming out, is that a major focus of these trials, or they just want to look at the therapy?
It is a tremendous focus of these. And in the U.S., the other big trial that will look at lapatinib is a CALGB neoadjuvant study,
right,
which will be a randomized trial in which patients with HER2 overexpressing disease will receive platinum-based chemotherapy or not, and trastuzumab or lapatinib or some combination. Obviously, in that specific study, there is tremendous hope that we will be able to find both traditional pathology markers and novel genomic-based pathology markers to help patient selection.
Any predictions in terms of how these markers are going to flesh out over the next few years?
I think it's going to be very hard to find markers that predict patients who should not receive trastuzumab when the tumor is HER2 positive. And if you look at Soon Paik's data, what's provocative in his c-MYC experience is that those tumors that are HER2 positive and c-MYC positive do really, really well with trastuzumab. And so for that patient group, maybe they don't need more than trastuzumab. But otherwise, I think it's going to be a lot of exploratory work for the time being.
I mean, it could just follow that same model that you've been talking about, which is maybe 5 years from now, or even before that, we'll have trials looking at HER2 positive, MYC negative. There'll be trials for them, and there'll be trials for HER2 positive, MYC positive.
I think there will be ongoing splintering, though. You have to remember that the thing that drives the fascination with the subsets right now is twofold. One is the biomarkers and the other is the availability of treatments. I mean, really, it is the availability of treating the tumors differently with focused agents that really distinguishes the research programs. And so unless we have a c-MYC therapy, I don't think you'll see such fascination with that. So just to round out the dialogue, you know, the biggest question I get at tumor boards right now is how to handle patients who have very small HER2-positive tumors, patients who wouldn't have been eligible for the adjuvant trials. You know, this is the 7-millimeter ER-negative HER2-positive tumor or the 1.2-centimeter ER-positive HER2-positive tumor. And we don't really have great data for what the outcomes are for these women. We have proposed, and I think we'll put forward, a multicenter trial looking at trastuzumab plus paclitaxel as a low-risk treatment regimen, and we will treat something on the order of 300 to 400 patients and try and show that the risk of recurrence is very low when you use adjuvant paclitaxel and then adjuvant trastuzumab for these women, suggesting that you might be able to omit the AC portion of their therapy or something like that.
Is it phase two or what?
This would essentially be a feasibility study looking to show that if you carefully select low-risk patients and give them a hopefully well-tolerated chemo-trastuzumab combination, that you could have a very low risk of recurrence. What we'd really love to see is a huge randomized trial for these women, but that's impractical given, you know, resources and given the generally low risk for the node-negative patients.
I've heard people talk about that approach, paclitaxel and trastuzumab, in the older, frail, comorbid situation, you know, trying to at least get some chemotherapy as opposed to, say, giving trastuzumab alone. Do you use that approach in your practice?
You know, I haven't used it that often, but I understand where they're coming from because, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, I actually think that giving chemotherapy plus trastuzumab with some overlap is probably a good thing, and it's probably not a bad thing to think about. There isn't a lot of data for that, and that's what we're hoping our study will fill the void with.
What about the triple negative tumors?
So for these tumors, obviously, we don't have a targeted agent to bring to their treatment. So the work that's going on with them has been focusing on optimizing chemotherapy, and there are trials that are looking at adding products like capecitabine or platinum-based chemotherapy to these patients. And additionally, there is interest in other biological approaches, and probably the one that's most far along has been interest in adding bevacizumab to these patients. In ECOG 2100, it looks like the ER-negative, HER2-negative patients did quite handsomely with paclitaxel plus bevacizumab. And so that is a very reasonable patient population to try and optimize chemotherapy and optimize other biological approaches.
Out of curiosity, in general, how would you think through a case of a woman with extensive symptomatic, poor performance status, visceral, metastatic disease, triple negative, who's never had chemotherapy, either presents that way, for whatever reason? How would you think through optimal therapy for a patient like that?
Well, obviously, you're going to give her chemotherapy, and I most frequently give patients like that paclitaxel plus bevacizumab. I find the data pretty compelling from ECOG 2100 that we can do better than just chemotherapy alone by adding bevacizumab treatment. I like the idea of bringing a relatively exciting biological therapy in. The other point is that there are relatively few women who walk in the door who are chemo-naive at that point.
Sure.
In fact, most of those women have had adjuvant chemotherapy.
Sure.
And have a tumor that's, you know, fairly resistant to chemotherapy, and that further encourages me at least to think about a novel biological approach.
Sure. It's just more of a mental exercise to tease out what I thought I've been hearing more and more from investigators, because obviously, whatever, 2 years ago or pre-ASCO 2005, my guess would be you would not have given that patient paclitaxel alone.
Well, we would have.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, this is the conundrum of concurrent versus sequential chemotherapy.
Yeah, well, see, but it's the old, you know, trying to get you guys to give combination by saying
right.
You have somebody who's super sick.
So I recently reread all these papers and wrote a review because we were writing a review for Hematology Oncology Clinics of North America that Andy Seidman, I think, is the editor for. And it turns out in the 1960s, as soon as they started using chemotherapy to treat metastatic breast cancer, there are these opinion papers being written. Should you use combination chemotherapy or should you use single-agent sequential chemotherapy? And it's good to know that now, 45 years later, we're still arguing the same points. The trials that have carefully built in planned crossover with use of single-agent chemotherapy have always shown equivalent survival to trials that use combination chemotherapy again, if you plan the crossover. If you don't plan the crossover, if you look at the registration type studies of, you know, chemotherapy A versus chemotherapy A plus B, designed to show bioactivity of chemotherapy combination B, those studies often show advantage for combination chemotherapy, but those aren't studies designed to test a strategy question. They're designed to show activity of B, and that's okay, but that doesn't mean you have to use B in that way.
Okay, well, it's actually, now that I'm thinking about it, we used to talk about that all the time, but since all the new stuff came out,
we used to talk about it all the time, and they have been for 45 years. Back then, you were doing this on Super 8.
Yeah, like, right, 8-track.
Exactly.
Okay, so what else is going on? And specifically, I want to ask you about your post-neoadjuvant metronomic bevacizumab trial.
Yeah, so one marker for identifying patients who are at greater risk for recurrence is to see what happens with their treatment and experience already. And there's been a lot of interest in neoadjuvant chemotherapy. The cooperative groups are making a lot of trials built around it. And the honest truth is that the vast majority of patients will have residual disease after they've had neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Even in the best case scenarios of optimal chemotherapy for estrogen receptor negative tumor, you know, the PCR rate is still on the order of 30-40%, which means 60-70% of women have residual cancer. And if you look at women who have ER-positive breast cancer, 90-95% will have residual invasive cancer after their neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And we know that these women are at higher risk for recurrence. So we have been focusing on this patient population to look at novel strategies. And in particular, we've started by looking at anti-angiogenesis strategies. The first study we have done was a feasibility study of bevacizumab given for 1 year to patients who had preoperative chemotherapy, who had residual disease at the time of their surgery. And this is a collaboration between ourselves at Dana-Farber, my friend Kathy Miller at Indiana University, and our colleagues at UCSF and UNC. So we have concluded the accrual to the first cohort. We are now into the second cohort, which is that same year of bevacizumab. And for the first 6 months of that treatment, we are using our low-dose oral metronomic chemotherapy program with cyclophosphamide and methotrexate. We're now accruing to that study. And there will be a third cohort, which will be bevacizumab paired with capecitabine. We're moving to capecitabine in part because there's just so much familiarity with that drug. And ultimately, what we would like to do would be a randomized trial in this patient setting where you would take women who had chemotherapy, had residual disease, and randomly assign them to chemotherapy or not, or to bevacizumab or not, to really ask a fundamental question about whether ongoing treatment would be beneficial. And because capecitabine is so familiar to oncologists and FDA approved, there are advantages to looking at the feasibility of that. So we believe this is a very exciting avenue of research. And I think the patient population makes a lot of sense for a couple reasons. One is, again, these are relatively high-risk patients who don't have standard chemotherapy options available to them. The second is that these are all tumors that, by clinical definition, have some relative resistance to chemotherapy. They had persistent disease after 4 to 5 months of chemotherapy. And so I think it makes a lot of sense to try and introduce newer strategies for their care. So that's been a very exciting piece of work. My colleague at Dana-Farber, Erica Mayer, has really spearheaded this with me, and we are very much looking forward to sharing those data soon.
You know, it seems like a few years ago there was a lot more enthusiasm about preoperative therapy in general, I think. Now there's a lot of enthusiasm because of tissue studies, et cetera, but in terms of as a clinical strategy, if you had a patient who had a palpable tumor that had not been removed, in the long run, do you think a patient would be better off like that, would be better off? I mean, putting aside the research issue, getting neoadjuvant therapy, even if it's only 2 centimeters, assessing pathologic response at surgery and then taking the secondary strategy as opposed to, you know, sort of getting the surgery and then starting?
The appeal of neoadjuvant chemotherapy for researchers is obvious. You can follow what happens to the tumor. And you can follow it clinically, radiologically, and these days you can follow it with serial sampling of the tissues, which makes for tremendous research opportunities. And the cooperative groups and other researchers have really pushed hard to look at that because they want to be able to analyze the tissues. They want to be able to look for early markers of biological activity. There are several issues, though, about the preoperative model that are worth highlighting. And I feel like I'm a Larry King, but I will shamelessly plug the book that Gary Lyman and I have edited called Breast Cancer Translational Therapies, and that's coming out in January 2007. It's for the oncology community. It's a textbook. But in there, I wrote the whole chapter on sort of the issues of preoperative therapy. So what are the issues? Well, the issues are, first, we've done some great work with preoperative therapy as a community, and what have we learned? We learned, first, that it's safe and feasible, and we have learned that it achieves long-term results equivalent to adjuvant therapy, and we have learned that it can downstage a small fraction of patients who previously would have required mastectomy and who now require lumpectomy, and that's obviously an important goal for many women. For patients who already require lumpectomy, it's not clear that preoperative treatment is better. In fact, it's clear it's not better than upfront surgery, but it's also not worse, and so there is this opportunity to explore clinical trials. The big challenge we have is to figure out what surrogate you look at in neoadjuvant therapy that would ultimately tell you something that's important for adjuvant treatment. So the best hope for that right now has been pathologic complete response. Unfortunately, that still only arises in a small fraction of patients. Even big jumps in pathologic complete response from about 15 to 25%, as were shown in NSABP B27 with the addition of docetaxel to AC, don't tend to translate into major differences in disease-free survival because the vast majority of patients still lack pathologic complete response. And because these, over time, a lot of other things like hormone sensitivity and availability of trastuzumab are going to negate the advantages there. So what we don't have is a situation where we said, aha, here's a neoadjuvant trial where we showed that there was a stepwise improvement in some endpoint that we know translates into a long-term endpoint of disease-free or overall survival that is clinically important to patients. So that's a big problem.
Thus the lack of enthusiasm.
Well, I think there's a lot of enthusiasm in the research community.
In terms of practical clinical use.
That's right. So it is a barrier, and so we have to overcome that. The CLGB is working on that. The NSABP has shown that you can do huge trials in this setting. And the question is, how can we really make it better? So again, what's happening? Well, there is this divide and conquer strategy. There are going to be, you know, trials for triple negative tumors where hopefully you can use shorter term endpoints to look at path CR to show that one regimen is better than another. The dilemma is that you still haven't shown that these later endpoints are so relevant. The other thing is that these triple negative tumors, they tend to have earlier recurrences anyway. So the historic argument has been you need neoadjuvant because you don't want to wait 10 years for all those terrible events to happen because it just takes too long. But of course, in the triple negatives, the events happen more quickly. In the HER2-positive patients, there will be similar neoadjuvant studies. Obviously, they will all include some form of anti-HER2 therapy. Again, the dilemma is how well does PathCR translate from a short-term endpoint to a long-term endpoint in that setting, especially when we know that they're going to be getting up to a year of trastuzumab afterwards. And for the vast majority of cases of breast cancer, the ER-positive cases, it's not clear that PathCR is a reasonable endpoint at all. I mean, these women have the best overall prognosis. They have the years, we've already talked about this, decades worth of anti-estrogen therapy looming ahead for them. They almost never have PathCR in response to either endocrine therapy or to chemotherapy, and yet they still have the best overall prognosis. So there's this big disconnect right now between what we know about PathCR and how we obviously should treat in the adjuvant setting for optimal treatment programs. So that's a big hurdle to widespread adoption of preoperative treatment. But on the other hand, everybody in the research community is so eager to do the correlative science, to look at these tissues, to figure these things out in a more timely fashion. And the preoperative model seems like the best way to approach that. So that's why there's the enthusiasm, and hopefully it will pay off.
What do you think about the NSABP B40 neoadjuvant study for HER2 negative patients, which is several different types of chemotherapy, docetaxel-based, docetaxel alone versus plus capecitabine versus plus GEM, and then the whole thing is plus or minus BEV?
Obviously, the NSABP has been the most successful cooperative group in breast cancer going back decades. So this builds on previous work they've done looking at AC with or without docetaxel. In high-risk settings, a lot of community physicians have contemplated adding more chemotherapy like capecitabine, like gemcitabine. The intergroup is going to do a study of AC followed by paclitaxel with or without bevacizumab. So there's tremendous interest in looking at bevacizumab in the early stage setting.
That's neoadjuvant?
That's not neoadjuvant. That's going to be an adjuvant trial.
Right.
The dilemma is going to be, you know, let's say you show that we know the pathological complete response rate docetaxel, let's say it's, you know, 22%, and you add capecitabine and it goes to 28%, and you add gemcitabine and it goes to 29%, and with or without bevacizumab, you add another 5%. The question is, what does that mean?
Well, what's it mean if it goes to 50%?
Well, if it goes to 50%, it hopefully means more, but you still got to follow those patients and show that it means something. So, for instance, 2 years ago, the MD Anderson group looked at trastuzumab in the neoadjuvant setting, and they showed that in a six-month chemotherapy program, if you added trastuzumab, you took the path CR rate from about 20% to over 50%. And I had the pleasure of discussing that abstract at ASCO and said that, you know, this was the foreshadowing of where things were at, and I thought it was pretty compelling data that in the neoadjuvant setting, trastuzumab would be valuable.
And also, I remember talking to you at that time and a bunch of other people, and I think it gave you all much more confidence that the adjuvant studies might be positive.
It certainly fueled that, and we had a lot of experience as well with neoadjuvant trastuzumab, and it supported the success that we had shown. So, you know, everything seemed right, and obviously that proved to be a great harbinger of what was to come. But if you didn't have the adjuvant data, people weren't going to use it just based on a 56-person randomized single-center study. Now, you could do much larger neoadjuvant trials, but again, you still needed the adjuvant data to make that a compelling story for most people.
I know right now it looks like, well, bevacizumab is coming in terms of trials in the adjuvant setting.
Yep.
Can you sort of provide an update of that?
So bevacizumab is certainly moving to the adjuvant setting, and we've talked about our post-preoperative trials, which we're very excited about. The intergroup will be running a trial, which essentially is a design of AC followed by paclitaxel with or without bevacizumab. They are still doing a pilot study to pick the best treatment arm for that. And what's exciting about this, obviously, is that bevacizumab is an encouraging drug. And if you believe the whole anti-angiogenesis model, if you believe the whole hypothesis that targeting the blood supply is going to inhibit the growth of tumors, the best place to look at that is going to be in the adjuvant setting because you have micrometastatic disease. It does not have a fully established blood supply already. And so if you believe the whole Judah Folkman hypothesis, this is really where you want to look at these kinds of drugs. And so I think these have the potential to be tremendously beneficial and important clinical trials. Obviously, one needs to do the studies, but there's a reasonable chance that the benefits will be even better in the adjuvant setting than in the metastatic setting.
How do you think the safety and tolerability profile is going to play out in the adjuvant setting?
I think it'll be feasible to give the drug. The median time to progression in ECOG 2100 with Taxol, paclitaxel plus bevacizumab was almost 12 months. It was 11 months. So we know that you can feasibly give the drug for a long period of time. What we don't know is what about those late side effects? What does it mean that 15 or 20% of patients will have hypertension? How is that going to affect their health, you know, a decade from now? We'll have to get the studies for that.